Well, hey, everybody. I hope you're doing great. I appreciate your showing up early. Remember, we're going to have a bit of an extended time at the end of the seminar for any discussion and questions that you'd like to talk about that we haven't maybe gone enough in depth or haven't covered. But first, anything you'd like to add or ask before we launch into our final topic today? Are any thoughts or reflections about what this has done to help you reflect on your change in transition or perhaps even in working with clients on theirs? Anything to add to the hopper? I'm sure a number of you know coaches maybe are doing this yourself to really focus on a niche of a specific transition or a specific change. Some of the more recent coaches I've worked with have focused on retiring from the military. You probably, if you want any words or concepts of this, of the language about this, a buddy and I did some retreats for executives who were CEOs or business owners who were within a year of retirement, looking at what they would do to plan for their next engagement or their next contribution. It's called What's Next Exec, and that's the website, WHATSNEXTEXEC. It'll give you .com. It'll give you some ideas about some of the language, the concepts of the kinds of things that can be encompassed in a focus like that. Thoughts, questions, anyone? Anything to add to the hopper to discuss to be sure that we cover in our final discussion?
Could you please give me that website again?
Yeah, What's Next Exec. There's no apostrophe. WHATSNEXTEXEC. Just for some ideas and concepts. And think about the, you know, I thought about this initially when I did a wholesale transition from practicing and teaching psychiatry psychoanalysis to mentor coaching, is working with professionals who were doing something similar, who wanted to play a bigger game, physicians especially, or who were in a process of some kind of transition themselves. So there are all kinds of things that you may think about, even in terms of niche or focused attention that could be beneficial in maybe applying some of the things that we're talking about to helping people in their own transitions. Hopefully this is helpful to you and to develop your professional story, but think about the applications as well. Other thoughts or questions? Anything else to talk about briefly before we move into the material? Well, jot down any questions, any thoughts you have, or anything you want to talk about or elaborate a bit more on at the end of our seminar, the official presentation. So I'm going to put us on lecture mode and then reserve some time at the end and then extend it if you're interested in having a discussion about anything. Okay, we're going to talk about in this final seminar some specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And I want to talk about, as I kind of began, a transition niche coaching. Here's just an application to think about and to look at ways to focus this in areas that you're interested in. Practicing professionals like healthcare, financial, legal, have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise, in a sense. their expertise to solve special problems and give specific advice is often backed by professional standards and substantiated by laws or codes. But now, even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specific advice, these professionals probably have not been trained for some of the things that you take as usual practice and engage in daily, to know themselves better, to understand the dynamics of human behavior, how to deal with stress as an obstacle to success, to pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional advancement, to convert from work ethic to performance ethic, and to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions, because they'd assumed, most likely, they'd do one thing, the profession they trained for, all their lives. Now, another genre, performance professionals, and this is a group that I have done work and have been very interested in, done research and writing. Performance professionals includes actors, artists, professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have, in addition to systematic skill development, is often self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success. And especially an example here is retirement transition for pro athletes. Now, I want to come back to discuss some things, maybe just in the discussion session, because I don't have any formal things to say to you about this, but some things I'd like to have you think about for application, some things I've been thinking about in doing interviews and research and writing more recently, and I want to share that just in case it might be of interest to you. But now here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths, the points of the play immediately following a really hotly contested moment of play. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to be more vulnerable to being derailed. The winner is excited by the victory. This carries over to affect the next play. The loser is frustrated, so this carries over in a similar way. These aftermath points and plays are likely to be lost on errors. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, conservatively, and with full concentration. Here's an example. The announcer at a Texans game had this to say about defensive lineman Casey. That's so often the case with young players. One good play and then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle on the next play, Casey was offsides. Clearly an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt, the excitement from making a really good play. Success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow a lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, yet tomorrow's the next day. Your career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything that you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own. Now, here's a kind of a précis of some things we can talk about if you're interested in the discussion mode. The research, writing, interviews I've been doing recently is for a book on handling extreme success, the accompaniments of extreme success, wealth, fame, power, influence. This is often something that people do not have a model for. The faster and the more extreme the success, the less likely they are to have a model for it. So this is a particular challenge. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant or often abrupt loss, like a job, a significant relationship, disability, or divorce. With these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. This also is one of our specialties as coaches. Then this task becomes important because it affects all other components of a situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce in the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management create challenges such as making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of the divorce and not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves off to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. A place that I see this kind of challenge in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company, founded 36 years ago, to two children to own and manage. It's a challenge. Every single person involved changes roles, relationships, function, responsibility. So this, I think, is important. Now, I mentioned the what's next exec. One of the things, and that's where the what is your unlived life came from when I did that. I mentioned that last time. This is for people who have been doing one thing, such as owning a company or a CEO of a company, for much of their professional lives, and they haven't had experience in doing other kinds of things, such as starting consulting, having a different contribution, many other things that the transition is something that can be a challenge in and of itself. So, let's look at this from one perspective. What do clients want from us? Have you thought about this in just a simple way? What do your clients really want from you? Now, I want to offer one perspective on that. The coach and client become co-authors of a new story for the client and create a current meaning that allows a distinctness of the old versus the new, an evolving new story for the client. Now, we're always teaching others how to respond to us, not consciously, logically, intellectually, but we always teach others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching the coach what it's like to be that client. It's an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that the coach can teach it back to the client out loud. This is the essence, I believe, of what happens most of the time in coaching. You have a framework for establishing the coaching collaboration to ask the client what they want to focus on, where they want to get to in that session, at the end to summarize in a sentence or so what the major thing they're taking away is and what they commit to do. Now, those four questions frame the coaching story each time, or your version of that will. The entire middle process of the engagement, the conversation, is the process of the client teaching you exactly what it's like to be that client, because their unconscious operating system that operates 90 to 95% of the time is evolving a story. So what we're doing then is listening for what that story is telling us, listening for if there are things that perhaps the client may not be hearing that may be necessary, limiting assumptions or beliefs unconscious biases, storylines that use old software and simply don't work anymore, a number of things that the client may not be accustomed to listening for or looking at, that we help the client look together collaboratively. So here's what I think we need to be open to that learning from the client and not let teaching a client our theories or let our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. This is a co-created space where the client develops an authentic story. So, what do our clients want from us as coaches? In my view, that's the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. We've got to enjoy it. Acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection so that we can give it back to its creator, the client, as self-statement. Full immersion in, but not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I got that from the X-Files, but I'm sticking to it. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result, to see the hope camouflaged in the sometimes frustrating process, to validate their intuition. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in this process. The architecture of trust silently forms while you talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story, to know that no matter how ready to change they are, it's like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I'm astounded that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together, coach and client, and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they'll teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had, perhaps the most. I also remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I've been heard to say something like this to clients: I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Maybe intervals of quarterly or at least yearly updates can be beneficial for coach and client, sort of like booster shots, witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals without having to have a problem as a ticket of admission. What we do with each client is not about being right, having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line always is, does it work? Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. I think Hemingway captured this principle when he wrote about the craft of writing. Write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, let's look at this important storyline together. How exactly are you taking care of yourself? How are you honoring your needs and ideals? Your relationships. Have you created something now that seems to be controlling you? Are you framing by yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a question, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, contemplate, or celebrate. So here's a distillation in my view of how we facilitate change in coaching. 12 caveats. 1, and this is in your outline. Each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Remember, each coaching story, each session we have with a client, the client takes ownership of that story by determining a focus and a destination. We become catalysts to co-create that together. 2, understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which don't. Then to change the ones that don't work. The ones that work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. 3, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. 4, distinguish what to accept, change, let go, and enhance. Those 4 questions. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go of what can result in significant effectiveness. 5, when people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. We commit to what we co-create. Questions direct, clarify, illuminate, even story bust. 6, someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain a new story. 7, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs, how they color what's perceived. Assumptions manifest as beliefs and behaviors by making assumptions explicit. Those which facilitate and those which interfere can become more visible. 8, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. To become successful, we have to learn from yesterday, perhaps anticipate tomorrow, but integrate new experiences all along in what we think and feel and experience. If someone is protesting change, they've already engaged it. 9. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. For example, professionals get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. It's a microsystem. 10. Solutions, causes, problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story, to align clients' needs and values, to strategize toward the client's goal. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically pursue goals, to create a new system together, beginning with the choice architecture of now. 11. A collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side, looking at the same scene together. Empathic resonance generates feeling understood. Then you can make powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what's positive will have several times the effect of focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental can result in a defensive reaction. And 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. And again, don't be afraid to be simple. A physician client who's completed the 26th grade may have forgotten how to talk simply. Remember, how you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated and internalized of how they can work with their patients or their clients. Now, I want to pause and look at something a bit different in terms of your needs and ideals to look at your wellness story. A significant aspect of a change and transition process is to attune to and build on a wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. The mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. He said, if you get a new car every few years, your approach would be different than if you knew from the beginning you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, probably do things more caringly, change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy. And wellness is an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place. So it consistently has to be assessed. Wellness is ideally not something you began to plan at age 65 or even 50. Every choice you make every day writes your wellness story. So this is something that let me give you just an example. Overall wellness is not based on one big monumental choice, but on little things. If you plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill, but after 10 get off, convince you're a little stiff, it's one small choice, no big deal. Nobody's ever had a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on the treadmill one day. Or you resolve to cut empty calories, grab a few M&M peanuts from the bowl. Never think about that. But you take in 100 extra calories more each day than you burn, and one year you gain 9 pounds. Our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. We are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. Now, this has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Let's look at one example. The story that we engage with our bodies is one of two possibilities, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge, Jr., who's devoted his professional lifetime as an internist in New York City, says that 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. Now, another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. The alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. Lodge wrote a classic that has been recently reissued and updated. It's called Younger Next Year. And the companion book for women is Younger Next Year for Women. I have recommended every one of my coaches who have done specialty certification, training, and wellness with me to be sure and have this book. Lodge said this, steady exercise is encoded as a message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. So a new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Lodge, after age 50, the recommendations from his findings, working out 6 days a week for the rest of your 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. He emphasizes 4 of those 6 days to be serious aerobic exercise the rest of your life. Because biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body and bathe cells in either repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that will kill you. Mortality falls with exercise. Of 3,000 people surveyed, 3 activities stood out above all others as one that prompted procrastination. More than anything else, people put off exercise, nutritional plan, and retirement plan. Now, on the other hand, and this is from Lodge's framing, on the other hand, work duties, projects, assignments are responded to routinely and promptly. So this suggests that a task like exercise be treated with the same mindset as work. With work, you don't get up every day and debate about whether you will or you won't go to work, whether you'll take a couple of days off or just skip it, or take off and really get with it next week. Work is there. You get up, you go to work, you don't debate whether you do or not. You don't consider yourself virtuous if you decide to go. In school, later in life, you show up. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. So this, he suggests, can be the same mindset of exercise. For some, it's like a new job. It's a commitment. For Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs, the default story. Now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer, you're not a dietitian, you're not giving directives, but you can certainly listen to how your client takes information and makes choices to write the next chapter, and you're always free to look at those choices or the trail of logic leading to them and to their fulfillment. Here's an example of an application of that. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, the making of new cells in your brain: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. The hippocampus is the part of the brain, in the midbrain, that's specifically connected with two things: creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus in the mice by almost 100%. Now, these findings have been replicated in non-invasive studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Exercise increases the number of hippocampal cells associated with memory and creativity by almost 100%. Another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus goes the other direction. So this is, I think, important to consider, because one question I ask as part of just an assessment, usually in the beginning of a first session with a client, is what do you do for regular workouts? Do you work out regularly? Just to get an idea of what they do. Now, here's an application that I think is interesting, and this has been increasingly studied in recent time. A study, and this is a prototype study by Princeton psychologist Emily Pronin, found that in making financial decisions, how much money someone has put toward retirement depended on how closely they identified with their future selves. In other words, those who could actually picture their future selves at like 70 and 80 and beyond saved about three times as much for their retirement as those who did not or had not pictured themselves at an older age. Now, more recently, there has been some studies, especially by a couple of institutes on the West Coast, of computer-enhanced aging and computer-enhanced trait representation. For example, for somebody who was smoking, the age progression of continuing to smoke exactly what they smoked, what they would look like in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, as opposed to stopping smoking. Same with diet, workout, a number of things that when someone is helped to picture a future self, and especially to compare and contrast continuing versus not continuing, doing versus not doing, especially something like regular workouts, can make a major difference. Your story hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. Now, by contrast, those who accomplish and believe, they have a different story in them, and their lives embody that story to pursue, to achieve for themselves and others. Their story within, their plot, guides them and orients them to script what they consciously write and live into it. Now, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen. We've even talked specifically about your client is always showing you exactly what it's like to be him or her. You're seeing the results. You're seeing the results of all the algorithms of that unconscious operating system that operate in present time. So that's why we never have to go back into the past or look at why or the history or the dynamics. If it's important, it's there. It's operating in the present. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapters of their life and business stories. So think about this. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would be the title and the subtitle? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what would it be? Write down your first answer immediately. Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. Just write down the title or what that scenario is. You can come back to it later. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? You already know. What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? You know that too. What events or process foreshadows your next success? This may not be quite as evident. What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And finally, what is your spiritual essence? Now, remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. So, I want to end by some reflections to move beyond the wide-angle lens that we've used at times to time-lapse photography. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, probably at each developmental phase. So, I'm an inveterate collector of quotes, and here are some quotes that I think capture what would take me way longer to describe. Here's how it may look in a relationship. This is from Ruby Dee, I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is from Wolfgang von Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, relinquish some, create new ones. Growth is flexible and dynamic. Once you achieve monetary success and professional prestige, you can figure out what's really important. Ideally before. Here's a caveat. Be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. And here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from my favorite essayist, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. So, here's a final exercise. I'd like you to do this exercise with me to get very comfortable, very relaxed. close your eyes and keep your eyes closed through this exercise. Breathe in relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Now, with your eyes still closed, imagine you're 90 years old. From that place of 90 years old, look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out if you took a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be very specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might really have seen right now, but maybe didn't acknowledge enough? What do you feel about your situation right now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risks that you should or shouldn't have taken? Keep your eyes closed and look carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. We're in discussion mode now, so you have live mic. I'm interested in thoughts or questions or reflections about anything that we've talked about or anything you'd like to talk about.
Well, this is Sandy.
Please,
and
go
you've
ahead.
convinced me that I need to keep up with my exercises every day, but that I also need to help my clients see that in themselves.
How would you do that without
telling them?
Yeah, right. Yeah, how are you going to get away with that?
Just, you know, what do you do to keep yourself healthy every day?
Okay.
That's where I would start.
Okay.
Because it's also a matter of diet.
Okay.
And
so you
try
get
to keep
them consciously aware of and reflecting on what they do and to see what kind of self-reflection and maybe even questions comes up for them as they're more aware of that and bring it into focus.
Yes.
That sounds very reasonable.
So thank you for that. I haven't even thought of that.
Yeah, one thing I do with clients is if there's anything that I have that will help them, when I say to them in the beginning that their monthly retainer will cover our meetings plus any material and resources, you know, I send them things that I've written or am aware of that may be helpful. I have sent the Younger Next Year to a handful of clients just for them to be aware of that and to incorporate it in what they do. And they have been grateful because they weren't aware of that kind of work.
Well, that's great.
So thanks for that, and that's a good, an excellent point. Who else? What else?
Yes, a question over here.
Yes.
This is Leigh.
Please, go ahead.
Regarding your wellness story, just a small question. The point that you mentioned about decay versus growth, and you mentioned that 70% of aging is decay. I think you mentioned an author, and I didn't get that.
I mentioned what else? I'm sorry.
The person who originated this idea.
Henry Lodge Jr., right, yes.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. The book is called Younger Next Year, and the companion book is Younger Next Year for Women.
Okay, great.
It's very readable and very, very experienced near. So I think
so
it could be beneficial.
Great.
Well, super. Other thoughts or questions? Or other applications any of you are thinking about? Has anything we've talked about changed any way you're thinking about or approaching your mentor coaching with clients? What has had an impact on what you are thinking about or doing differently, perhaps, if that's the case, now than 4 weeks ago? Anybody want to share anything about that?
Just a small thought. I just feel that my coaching is more fine-tuned, so to speak. The different points that you mentioned just help me to fine-tune my approach to the client. I appreciate that so much.
What would be an example of that, an application?
Basically, you've emphasized a lot about collaboration, and it speaks to me to be present with the client and really listen, you know, to what he's saying.
Yeah. Let me tell you a story that illustrates that. And the unique position that we have as professional coaches from any other professional engagement. You go to any other professional, a doc, an attorney, a financial professional, you ask some questions, you have a discussion, and the professional gives you a recommendation. Let's use the example of going to a physician. You go to a physician, and let's say an example of the recommendation a physician gives is a prescription. Now, you go to the physician, you're maybe scared, you're maybe in pain, you have some concerns, you get a prescription. What percent of people follow that expert recommendation? Less than 1 in 2. Slightly under 50% of people do not fill the prescription. Of those who fill it, slightly less than 50% take it as directed. So even when someone's motivating, gets a specific recommendation from a professional, less than 1 in 4 actually follow through. This kind of fits with what we began with talking about, you know, how do you get somebody to change? Well, you don't tell them what to change or what to take, because that often doesn't do it. What we do in coaching that is unique to coaching is a collaborative framework. We together engage the client to look at their focus on what story they want to write for that session, that coaching story, and then how that fits into a bigger picture of the entire coaching collaboration. So when somebody co-creates, they much more likely commit to it. So we're helping them write their story in a better and more specific way. So that, I think, is one of the unique aspects we do as professionals, is to establish a collaborative framework. And I think it makes a lot of difference. So thanks for mentioning that and highlighting that. What else? Other aspects that you are doing differently or thinking about doing differently? Or anything you want to try out loud here on our group?
Something that I'm thinking about differently.
This is
Susan.
Okay, yeah, please, go ahead.
Something that I'm thinking about differently, and to be honest, this is not so much, I mean, it has relevance for clients, but really this hit me personally as I'm personally going through some change and transition, was just the need for a new paradigm when you're making changes, and the fact that it's more complex than just I'm going to make this change, I'm going to go from point A to point B, but there needs to be sort of that deconstruction and then reconstruction. You can't just carry the old baggage into the new place. It's not going to work. So that aspect of things was very, very meaningful for me personally.
I think that's very well put, because that's so much of what we do as coaches is we can't just superimpose a change on an old story, because the plot of that story may change. There may be loss, transition, illness. What happens when things change and we really are required to do things in a new or different way? So that's part of the evolution and really examining the entire structure and framework. So I think that's very, and that's why it's so helpful, I believe, to know our own story quite well, because we're then able, in a much better way and more flexible way, to help clients develop their story and not superimpose our story or ghostwrite or run in a play. And that's why I think it's so helpful to do mentor coaching. I've worked with maybe four different mentor coaches at this point in my coaching career, each around a specific area of work that I needed to do. And, you know, I have people who come back and say, Dave, I just need to schedule a session with you around a client this had a challenge. So we'll pick up right where we left off 2 years ago and look at that issue, and that's enough. So I want to encourage you to think about doing this work yourself and whatever it takes to help you in this way. So thanks for mentioning that. I think it's really significant that we're continuing to grow and evolve. You know, one way, and this is just personal, but one way that I continually address this is I write about what I most want to learn. So I've been writing about all along what I most want to learn. I mentioned earlier this seminar about things that we may need to help our clients with that they have absolutely no model about how to deal with it, like extreme success, you know, fame, power, wealth, things that, you know, you think about a pro athlete goes from zero to $60 million in 10 seconds of signing a document. They don't quite, no matter how much they've been accustomed to success and cheering crowds, they don't have a model for dealing with that. In fact, Keith Richards said it, I think, very succinctly. He said, you know, fame has killed a lot more guys than drugs and alcohol. So I think there are all kinds of ways that, I mean, we're seeing it now, the effects of hubris, the effects of fame, of wealth, in ways that someone isn't regulated or dealing with it well, and it results in catastrophes. So I think we will increasingly be able, as coaches, to work with people who really don't have a developed model for dealing with some of the challenges and the issues, especially the successes. I mean, sometimes, you know, people have got feeling bad down, and the greatest challenge is to feel good, remarkably good, and have remarkable success. So I think those are also things that we need to be ready to work with and think about. So other thoughts, other questions?
This is Sandy again.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you write about what you most want to learn. How do you go about doing that? Can you give me a little bit more information?
I decide what I want to learn about. My most recent example, out of a book manuscript that I've completed on applying the mind, brain, and performance sciences to enhancing performance. Hard Work Miracle Playbook is a working title. Came the recognition that there were aspects of not only clients I'm working with, but other people, and other people who I decided to study, and people, a handful of people who work in this area that I wanted to interview and read about the paradoxes of extreme success, about how to navigate and sustain fame, wealth, power, so that these kinds of things are things that can be studied and applied to coaching to help people navigate these sorts of things, and to help them, for example, success anticlimax for somebody who has been engaged in something for a long period of time and finally achieves success. For example, Bruce Jenner, after spending almost four decades of being an athlete, the morning after his last competition, he got up and said, "What am I going to do with the rest of my life?" Someone who has had an achievement that's been long anticipated, long planned for, suddenly gets there, and there's a success anticlimax because the whole sprint system, even though it's for years, of dopamine, of the excitement and the pursuit and the anticipation, suddenly when they arrive and have that success, it's an entirely different neurochemical system sustained for the marathon. It's the norepinephrine primarily. So it registers as, this is not exciting. This is not what I planned for. There's nothing left anymore. So that whole transition is important in its own right. So how do you sustain motivation to continue to do the things and the contributions? How do you navigate achieving and then sustaining success? It's all still part of a growth mindset. Let me give you an example of one of the things that that intrigued me on the front end of this. One of the people I follow and collaborate with, Angela Duckworth, who wrote probably the one you're most familiar with, is Grit. She had been jogging an hour a day, several days a week, since she was 18 years old. So for over three decades, she had been working at this. And she realized she had not gotten any faster in all that time. She had spent thousands of hours, and she was still practicing but not improving. And so she went to a guy who at the time was the chief scientist in this area, Anders Ericsson, in Florida, who engaged in, for the first time, many of us thinking about deliberate practice and successful performance. So she went to Professor Ericsson, told him what was happening, because this 10,000-hour rule had come from some of his work. You practice 10,000 hours, you get experted. But she'd practiced 10,000 hours. She wasn't an expert. So Ericsson asked her five questions. Do you have a specific goal for your training? Before you go for a run, do you have a target in terms of the pace you'd like to keep? Do you have a distance goal for each run? Is there a specific aspect of your running you focus on and try to improve each time? And five, do you have a coach? Those are all five questions of deliberate practice. Her answer to each of those was no. And Erickson said, I think I understand. You aren't improving because you aren't practicing right. So it's not that practice makes perfect. Practice makes permanent. Whatever you practice, you etch it in your brain, and it makes it permanent. It doesn't make only perfect practice makes perfect performance. So this is why, among other things, for deliberate practice, you need to focus on improving in a systematic way and having a mentor coach to do that. That's what we do with people in their business and lives. So this is something that I think is important and can inform us in various ways of doing things. So does that, and what I, you know, what I do is focus on what I'm doing next and have everything fit into that. This is not about me, but you ask a little bit, and I want to give you a little bit of a glimpse, that whatever I'm doing, I'll fit into whatever I'm working on to enhance that, to make that all part of the same flow. So I'll present something that fits into what I'm doing. I'll, you know, agree to be a guest on something or to do an ICF training if it fits in what I'm doing. And then I get immersed in my own personal retreat to spend a few weeks every fall in a quiet Creole home in the French Quarter, mostly doing writing. I still work with clients and do training, but I get immersed in that, so that's my, that may be as close to heaven as I get, but that's enough. So I have a focus and a pursuit of what I'm doing next. So does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, great. And if you do a blog, think about what do you most want to learn in doing a blog. And the blog may be cumulative, a portion of another contribution of a seminar, a webinar series, maybe even a book.
Okay.
When McGraw-Hill nudged me in no uncertain terms when The Secret Language of Money came out some time ago to do a blog, I didn't really want to do a blog, but they nudged me and I agreed. And I got interested in it. I began to find all sorts of things bloggable. And after about 3 years, I had the subject matter from doing the blog series for almost half of the sequel to Secret Language. So it can be cumulative. It can be focused. And it can be really enhancing. And I was able to get all kind of feedback from people, as I'm doing from you guys mm-hmm. now, about what's helpful and what's not, which is very important to me. Other thoughts, other questions? Anything else you'd like to talk about we haven't really really touched on? Are any applications to coaching that you have questions about?
Well, this is Sandy again. I have lots of questions. Sorry. When you first have a client, do you end up asking them a lot of questions on their first session? To get to know them better? I mean,
well,
talk about a lot of things that's important.
Okay. Well, I do two things. One is I have a brief discussion with someone to determine what they really want out of coaching, what they see as a major issue or focus for coaching. And then if I make a recommendation for mentor coaching, I will make that recommendation, spell out exactly what it would look like, and then ask them to do two things. One is to fill out a client information packet that's 2, 3, maybe 4 pages of questions about what they see as their primary challenges, what they want from me, a bit of, you know, important people and that sort of thing, and the last is an agreement. and I'll have them fill that out and send that to me before our first scheduled session. So I'll have that, and they will have already thought about it. So we'll begin immediately with looking at of the things they mentioned they want to accomplish in working with me, what would they like to begin with, so that they're clear about the scope of things and then focus together on what we deal with first, but then we have that guide that they've already thought about and filled out mm-hmm. and sent to me, and I print that and put it in a folder so I have it as ready reference. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
So we hit the ground running the first session and look at beginning with what they've determined as first up of the things that they want to deal with.
Great
question, yeah. And I know some of this, everybody has very different approaches and that sort of thing. And I hope this is helpful to get an idea about how it may look for each of us, maybe in a different way.
Yes, definitely so.
Other things that you'd like to talk about? Well, I hope that this has been helpful. If you have other questions that you think about, or those of you who didn't or couldn't join, especially this evening, if you have questions, fire an email. I'll be happy to respond. If I can be of help to you in any way, I'll be eager to do that. And I really appreciate all of your input and interaction and energy. It's been a privilege doing this with you, thinking about it and applying it with you. And I hope this is a continuation. So thanks very much, and let me know if I can be of help to you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Bye now to you guys.
Bye.